You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Can only come from you. Get to people, yeah. What are you gonna people.
Who you gonna turn to next?
Tell me.
People.
You gotta take a look at yourself. Get some people.
Where do you wanna be?
Where you wanna be?
Tell me what your life is.
What's with your life?
Running like a red disease.
Running like a red disease. Stop doing what you're doing to yourself, young. You got to learn to love yourself.
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we view the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission, to our ancestors whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future. We all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe, civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the Maafa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Maafa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity. Because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted, and we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and in honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashay. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshie. Hotep family, hope everything was well with you today. Hope you can have a good day and a good weekend. I hope you get a chance to do all the things you want to do, should do, must do, can do, and will do. And I hope the weather will be accommodating for you to do it. But of course, you know, if it is not and it has to get done, it must get done, you will do it. And you'll do it safely. My brothers and sisters, you're listening to African Perspectives. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific, or any other time around the world. But if you cannot listen to this program live, you can always go to our archives at timeforanawakening.com. At the top of the page, you'll see podcasts. Click on that, and the drop-down, you'll see African Perspectives. Click on that, and there will be programs that are dated and titled. We're not going to deal with, we have a special guest today. In fact, this program is being taped, so no call-ins, please. This program is being taped. We have a very special guest we're going to get to, but we're going to read the Inye Sesem of Daily Revolutionary Thought, as we always do. And, of course, this being Friday, we'll read 3 days, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. July 22nd. Don't let the Joneses get you down. Temptations. Relative to real power in a capitalist system, capital is synonymous with wealth. In this system, power is exercised through the possession and control of wealth, not income, in every social institution. Based on this definition, Urugu controls the bulk of the wealth in Western society and therefore the bulk of real power. Whether they are devaluing numerical minority or not, and that's a big important thing. It doesn't make any difference if they're the numerical minority. They're always in control. But of course, they're devolving here in the numerical minority or not. It is irrelevant to this fact. Relatively speaking, and whether we know how the word minority is used against us or not, Africans are the most disadvantaged economic minority in the Western world. If we are speaking in real wealth terms among the economically dispossessed, internal competition serves the economic powers that be. In this case, Urugu, and in every other group that uses it, has a doormat into Urugu's house. We compete over who can be best economically exploited. This is a function of a group, an individual menticide and misidentification, because if this were not the case, we, like every other group that exploits us, would prioritize cooperation over competition, whether we personally like each other or not. If this is to be corrected, we have to start defining community from a centered perspective and seeing each other as family. We must consciously act to assist each other and applaud and genuinely feel good about the aspirations and gains of those we know are family. The proverb about when siblings fight, strangers inherit their parents' estate has wide, commonsensical applications to our situation. Economic envy has no place on the front line. As the model, our ancestors competed with self in order
to improve the overall community by bringing the best of us and out of ourselves to the collective table and for the collective good. Affirm, I'm in economic competition with no African. Affirm, I am in economic competition with no African. July 23rd. Every onlooker is either a coward or a traitor. Franz Fanon. For those who are cowardly enough to make the argument that we should not be talking about war with Urugu in military terms because of the technological destructive advantage, just look around. Just as they have always done on the international scene, they have been consistently, intensively, and consciously preparing for domestic war for decades. So it makes no difference whether you claim that a military victory is impossible against their greater military might or not. They are coming. If an argument is all it takes for a knuckle under to confuse you, then you are never secure in your knowing. It was only wishful thinking that came out of a frustration over not being Urugu. So if this excuse is the logic behind your defeatist attitude, the only choice you have is of whether you and those you are responsible for safeguarding are prepared to die easily or with any degree of difficulty and dignity. If an enemy is determined to kill you, foolishly pointing out that they have the capability of doing so, whether real or imagined, only affirms that you have already surrendered to defeat. It is evident that you live only with the blind hope that you will somehow survive the massacre and that for some unknown reason you will be amongst the pets mercifully selected to serve them in the aforementioned. Of course, history bears out the fact that such generosity is not in Urugu's nature and has progressively become less so. Affirm, I am not an onlooker. I seek solutions within the fray. Affirm, I am not an onlooker. I seek solutions within the fray. July 24th. Spirituality is about how we think, how we behave, and how we treat others. The only way to think spiritually is to learn and come to know spiritual principles. You are behaving spiritually when you are living the spiritual principles you learned. Most importantly, spiritual people treat others with respect, fairness, and kindness. William Dempsey and Bakari Atiba. The human mind is only capable of sanely working within one domain, culturally operating system. Any other culture's thought and behaviors are filtered through and or sanctioned by the dominant culture operating system. For most Africans, the dominant culture operating system is Urugu's. More and more of us have convinced ourselves that we can solve this problem of dualism by ascending into a fantasy that gives us a godly individual mission of spiritual self-evaluation. And in doing so, these Africans have convinced themselves that European culture is no longer defining their existence or guiding the form their transformation into higher planes, which into higher planes take. The divine individualism that they so hopelessly run toward in order to avoid the responsibilities of confronting the enemies of our children and their future has fed them to excuse themselves from being responsible adults and members of an African community that is working towards sovereignty. The only problems for these divinity aspiring individualists are problems of the self. Character and accountability to others is irrelevant except as a cover to conceal their self-centered inhumanity. This spiritual escapism is a religion of me. In it, there is no we. There are only competing versions and visions of the one for those spiritualitists. Regardless of version or vision, the one is only concerned with them and their peace. Affirmed, I am guided by spirit. Affirmed, I am guided by spirit. Brothers and sisters, the Inye Sesim of Daily Revolutionary Thought. My brothers and sisters, I have a very special guest today, a brother who I've been seriously impressed with over the times when we met and coming to community meetings and discussing problems that happened with us. He is very knowledgeable, particularly of issues outside of our community, which is international, particularly in the Caribbean. I'd like to introduce you to Brother Kwaku Lumumba. Brother Kwaku Lumumba, good morning.
Good morning, good morning, and thank you for having me on the program.
No, thank you for taking the time out for us to do this. In fact, I wanted to have you on sometime before, just didn't communicate with you, but this is the right time when you consider what is going on right now. And I'm quite sure you are going to enlighten us with some things that are happening in Haiti. And brothers and sisters, once again, that's how Haiti is pronounced, Haiti, you know, and also what's happening in Cuba, you know, since all this madness has been taking place. But first, let our audience know who you are. You know, all I mentioned is your name, but you're a young man that has been very involved nationally, internationally. In fact, in working with you during last year's 25th anniversary, excuse me, last year's African Liberation Day, and you were you're a member of the Congo, Friends of the Congo. I know that's one organization, and there's many others. But go ahead, introduce yourself, please.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Does it sound all right? Yeah, I can hear you fine. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So you mentioned a little bit about my connections to the African world and organizationally as well. But, you know, I'm glad that you read what you read before we had this discussion, because I am somebody who's guided by spirit in revolution.
I say.
And that has brought me to the places where I have been and the places where I have yet to be. And I am grateful to my ancestors for everything that they have given me thus far and everything that they have in store for me. And I just ask that I am remain aware so that I can be prepared for those things that I have yet to experience.
I pray that you are continually guided and more importantly, protected. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. That's important. And we'll see how important that is as we go into our discussion, because there are many brothers and sisters who have fallen in the course of revolution. And, you know, it's really, that's the best that we can ask for, because we all will go one day. And if we're going to go, I'd rather be able to say that I went in the course of engaging in revolutionary struggle.
Ashe, that's right. Go down fighting, Jack. If I must die, let it not be like a hog. Yeah, Ashe. Okay.
Ashe. So I want to give, you know, in the light of the ancestors, I want to give why it is that I'm connected to these places, Cuba and Haiti in particular. As I go and as I grow and learn more about myself through my ancestors, I learn who they are, where they have been, and the journeys that they traveled in their lifetime and the things that they passed on to me. So the connection to Cuba and the connection to Haiti are not, for me, merely sentimental things. They're not merely historical talking points, but they are part of an ancestral legacy, which I don't talk about often, because I don't feel like it's important to talk about that in all spaces all the time. But in this space, especially because of how you opened it up with libation and these remarks about daily revolution, I think it's important to give honor and respect to these ancestors in this way.
I say.
I was born in the United States, in the occupied territory of the United States. And I was born on the Gulf Coast. And I have a long line of ancestors who also were born on the Gulf Coast and the Louisiana Territory, so on and so forth in that area. My great-great-great-great-grandfather was born in Cuba. He was an African man who journeyed from Cuba to the Louisiana Territory for the express purpose of liberating his wife, who was born in Africa, and did so making sure that he could liberate his children as well. And because he did that, they were able to grow up in freedom and be able to pass that freedom on from generation to generation, from the early 1800s to my birth, in the same area, the same region of Louisiana, where this happened. So I recognize the connection to Cuba, to that space, the African connection to that space, and an ancestral love of our people that would drive somebody who did not have to go. He could have been complicit in the process and say, you know, I love you, baby, but I'm not getting involved in
it. Yeah, no, hey, you know? We laughing, but you know that's a lot of cats, man. Ain't gonna... That's sad, but that's, yeah.
So, you know, I have to honor that legacy.
Definitely. So, dude, that's great.
Yes. I mean, because, I mean, when I look at the records and see how much he spent in liberating his children and his wife, you know, this is something that almost took a decade of his life and a decade of resources, of hard work, just to put his resources toward liberating them, because he purchased them out of slavery. And I look at the environment in which he chose to be, he struggled to raise free children, a free family, and surrounded by this slave state, and working to be an example of how it is that we establish liberation in the midst of enslavement, in the midst of colonization, and be able to preserve that from generation to generation, where the children were never enslaved again, and their children and the children's children never succumbed to enslavement. Up until, of course, the emancipation period. The Haitian or the Haitian connection is in the same space and in relatively the same period, but it was the Haitian Revolutionary period at that time, in the 1791 to 1804. My great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was born in Haiti, and he migrated to the Louisiana Territory in that same period for the express purpose of advancing the Haitian Revolution beyond the borders of what we call Haiti today, beyond the island landmass that they used to call Saint-Domingue, or they used to call Hispaniola. And of course, as you know, it was indigenously called Haiti. And so he, in engaging in that opportunity to advance revolution abroad, ultimately and unfortunately, the plan was uncovered. The plan was foiled, and many of his comrades were assassinated, were killed by the colonial state. Their heads were put on pikes. There'd be a warning to anybody else who would like to do that. But he and some of the other lead conspirators were exiled to Cuba. And so they had prison camps in Havana, Cuba, in which he and others were exiled to. And so it's, you know, it's a strange relationship in the same period of time with Cuba and Haiti that I have ancestrally. And so I have to honor that. I have to respect that. I have to continue that legacy and uphold that legacy, because for so many of us, we don't know those ancestors at that period of time. We don't know what they were doing. And so the fact that I was able to uncover what they were doing, who they were, and why they were, and receive that information, is something that I have to take very seriously, and I do. So I'm grateful to be able to talk about that a little bit on your program and share organizational experiences as well in relation to both of those great, great countries.
Well, that is fantastic, because very few people can trace their family, let alone outside of the U.S., but even within the U.S., most of it is, you know, we from Georgia or we from Mississippi or we from Louisiana. Outside of that, they don't know. And even at that, that is sketchy. So this is outstanding, brother. I really appreciate you sharing this with the audience.
No problem. It's my pleasure. So organizationally, I am a member of Friends of the Congo. And I am also a member of a socialist organization in Haiti. I serve as the external relations coordinator. The name of the organization is COSA, or that's the acronym for the organization. The name of it is Combat Citoyen Socialiste du Sauvetage Haïti, which translates roughly in English to socialist citizens working together to save Haiti. Now, in your introduction, you talked about cooperation of African people and not competition. And I think it's important to just reflect on the first word of the name of the organization, which is Combat. And an IEP, Combat, is collective work and responsibility, basically. And so it is something that has gotten our people through hard times, not only in IEP, but everywhere in the African world, when we had nothing, little to nothing, in our hands. And so you have whatever it is that you can bring to the table, whatever it is you can bring to the project, and then everybody else brings whatever they can bring to the project, and together we make it work.
We've
been able to see our people overcome in some seemingly insurmountable odds this way. And so it's something that we have to remember and continue to use, because in this capitalist system, we tend to fall into the idea that, oh, I have to have such and such amount of money before I can do anything. I need to be a millionaire, or I need to make $30 an hour. I need to make such and such income before I can help the community, before I can invest my energy, my resources into any project in this community. But that's a trap. That's a trap of capitalism, and the bar keeps going up higher and higher and higher, so that we're never able to overcome the traps of capitalism. We just continue to chase this carrot on a stick, if you will, but we're never able to get it. But with Combat, you take whatever we have, whether it's 2 cents, or even if you have no sense, but you have your two hands, you bring that to the table and you do the work to make it happen. And so that's something we have to remember as a people, that this is indigenous to our African culture. It is preserved in IEP, and it has allowed our brothers and sisters in IEP to persevere through unspeakable hardship over the past 200 plus years of independence.
And that's something that, you know, as you were talking, and I was thinking how this country demonizes collective work and responsibility, cooperation, cooperatives, and so forth. It demonizes, but yet it uses them. There's a lot of social programs. There's a lot of socialism in it. But, of course, they don't want you to know or even understand that these programs exist, because they want you to believe in capitalism. They want you to believe in get all that you can get. That is more important to get than it is to give or share. That's what they want you, because that's what this is about. That's what America is about. America is about individualism, materialism, greed, and violence. That's what America is. And so they don't want you to talk about, you know, pooling resources, doing for yourself, doing for each other, cooperative buying and so forth. They don't want you discussing that. They see that within the government and even outside within various organizations and so forth. You know? That they try to bring fear into those who talk about that. You know, that as if that is something very evil. No, what's very evil is capitalism. Anytime you have a system where only a few people benefit tremendously at the expense of all others, that's an evil system. You know? And we've been operating within that system far too long.
Yes, I agree. So that's why we're doing that work, to transform the material conditions in IEP. in such a way that every human or every person can live as a human being and not as, like you said, as a hog that, you know, that's been brought to slaughter, but as a human being with full dignity and full opportunity to live out their dreams with the resources that happen to be right beneath their feet.
That's right.
So, yeah.
And it's, what's interesting, Haiti has a lot of resources, just like Africa has a lot of resources. Interesting that the places where religion, particularly Christianity, and these forms of government are, they're very poor, but they're rich in resources, but they're very poor as far as the people are in their lives. You know, I understand that Haiti has mineral wealth. I was listening to another program here on this platform, and there was a sister, dynamic sister out of Haiti. Can't remember the sister's name. You know, I'm not sure if she was an ambassador or a professor. I know Baina Bello. She's a friend of mine, but it was not her.
Yes.
It was another sister, and she was talking about there's some mineral wealth of Haiti, gold within Haiti, you know, might even be some oil around with Haiti. Well, oil's a different subject because we don't need oil. Oil is the problem that has messed up the ecology. So let's be real about that. Climate change and all the things that are happening is because of oil, fossil fuels. So, but yet and still, that wealth is there, but the people don't benefit from it, you know?
That's true. There's gold in Haiti. There are tons of mineral deposits in Haiti that have been taken advantage of by U.S. military apparatus. Of course, there's oil. There's enough oil to rival Venezuela's deposits that they've been using.
Is that right? Because Venezuela's oil, you know, and I remember when Hugo Chavez worked with a number of organizations here in the States to help provide heating oil. This is when Bush the idiot was president, you know, and they were going to provide heating oil, I think it through Citgo. And because I know I was in Milwaukee then, and a number of families and a brother who used to be the alderperson, you know, organized it and set that up. And so a lot of people who needed heating oil for their fuel to warm their homes that winter received it, and which was very much needed, you know. So I didn't know they had oil like that.
It is, and it's untapped. And we can talk about why that is. Mm-hmm. Because you would think that at least, if not IEC, then one of the imperial powers, like the United States, would want to tap into it. But there's a need for reserves, because as we look at the oil and other resources that are being used by various superpowers, the one that has the most reserves at the end of the day is the one that's going to win these kind of resource wars. And so the United States is very interested in maintaining a reserve around IEC that is not tapped into, as opposed to other places that have used oil to fuel their economy, but because they didn't have access to other reserves, the United States has been able to block them out. And they just, you know, eventually, the same way with Venezuela, for example, that rose up under Hugo Chavez because of its oil, but then because it was so oil dependent, the economy struggled after a lack of diversity with the resources and the ways that the economy was being sustained and supported. You know, it's important to have various mineral reserves, at least in this economy. Hopefully we can change against that, because you mentioned the ecological consequences of just draining the earth of its resources for the for the purpose of fueling the economy. But in this economy, that mineral resource, to be able to tap into that, is important for fueling an economy and keeping the economy solvent. And so the United States understands that. And it understands that if it maintains control of certain reserves, that other nations won't be able to rise up and stay up, because they won't have access to these reserves and access to be able to trade with nations that already have reserves and don't need to trade for them.
Tell me, let's switch to Cuba. Let's talk about Cuba, and then we'll get back to Haiti in more depth, particularly after the we come to a break. Cuba, when Batista was in Cuba and Cuba was being run the way it was ran by Batista, probably even before then, and of course the European looking Cubans who had wealth, who had, you know, plantations, so to speak, and of course the Africans who were on the island of Cuba basically served them, you know, and of course Batista did not want to relinquish power like so many unfortunately dictators do. And you know, the United States was in favor of him and it supported him. And of course you could go to Havana and you know, do all kind of vice, prostitution, gambling, and so forth. It was all like that. And of course Fidel Castro went into, because I think he had an attempt. He tried to do it through the legislative process. It didn't work. He tried an attempt militarily. That didn't work. And then he went into hiding in the southern eastern portion of the island of Haiti, because Havana is the northern portion, northwestern portion of the island of Haiti. And that's ironic that in that area is also Guantanamo Bay, which of course the United States still has a prison on the island of Haiti. You know, some of the things that happen, you'd be like, damn, how does that happen? Here they have been trying to kill the leader of Haiti, trying to take over Cuba, all kinds of things, and yet they still have a prison on the island of Haiti. But anyway, then
on the island of Cuba?
On the island of Cuba, I'm sorry. But and so then he makes his move and he defeats Batista, and Batista is exiled and he later passes. And of course, the United States is angry at the fact that this happened, you know. And then, of course, the Cuban people, they needed some assistance. And it wasn't going to come from the United States. And it couldn't come from the other islands because of the control that the other European countries have. Because these Caribbean islands, I've always said that the Caribbean really is a playground for Europeans, a place that they go when they want to go to Trinidad or Barbados, or they want to go to St. Thomas, St. Kitts, and whatever, you know.
Sure.
And so, you know, you can't speak forcefully on that. That's just like when they got together, I think, who was that? Was that Reagan or is that old man Bush when they invaded Grenada, when they invaded Maurice Bishop and the New Jewel movement in Grenada?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right,
and killed him, you know. And so anyway, they began to, you know, plot to kill Fidel Castro. They had the Bay of Pigs, which of course was foiled by the Cuban people and those individuals. And these are these exiled Cubans in South Florida, you know, who did that. These are the exiled Cubans. What I consider to be more Caucasian Cubans, you know, the more who have more money, right, and so forth, you know, and they wanted to, you know, sending Fidel Castro exploding cigars, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what, is there some ridiculous number on the attempts on his life? You know, I mean, this is a ridiculous,
over 630
attempts. That's what I'm saying. That's ridiculous. And that's true, because, I mean, I read that some many years ago. Like, this is crazy. But anyway, so, you know, that being the case, and then, of course, the ally that Cuba had became the Soviet Union. And to protect Cuba, they moved missiles into the area. And of course, that created the missile crisis. And I was a young boy back then. You know, I was, that was in the 50s in elementary school. And we used to practice air raid drills all the time, man. You know, moving to the basement, tucked under seat, head cover, head under, you know, missile crisis. I mean, all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then once that was abated, but yet and still, they continue to challenge Cuba as a country, the embargo, the isolation. And so even when Fidel made his transition, the celebration of his death in South Florida was sickening to me, you know, but I understand, you know, like one was crying about the fact that he had to leave Cuba. They were very rich. They had a nice farm or plantation raising bananas and tobacco, whatever, you know, but they did not want to share that. They did not want to have that being taken over by the Cuban government. So they'd rather leave and take whatever riches they had, you know. And then, of course, when his death happened, they were talking about maybe now we can come, you know, and take over Cuba, get our stuff back. But, of course, that didn't happen. And then the other thing is that under Barack Obama, he was trying to help with some normalization of relationships with Raul Castro. What did you think about that?
Well, if I may, I wanted to go back a little bit.
Sure, please do.
And just mention, you know, Cuba has a very strong history as far as African people are concerned in the Americas, because Cuba is the first place in which there was an organized African political party. And this was in 1908, in which they organized the Colored Party for Independence in Cuba. And so you have war veterans, people who fought, Africans who fought for independence in Cuba, who then formed their own political party to make sure that their rights could be respected by the government that was mistreating them. And so African self-determination has always been a part of this process in Cuba, even before Fidel Castro was born. Now, I wanted to remark on what you were talking about with the Cuban Missile Crisis, because a lot of people, due to U.S. propaganda, look at the embargo or the economic blockade against Cuba as justifiable, because in their mind, the Cuban Missile Crisis is the impetus for this, that Cuba would be so bold as to arm itself with the nuclear weapons right on the doorstep of the United States, aligning itself with the Soviet Union in the process of doing this. But in fact, you had already mentioned that the Bay of Pigs, the U.S. struck first. The U.S. struck first. The Bay of Pigs invasion, which was a CIA operation in which they recruited these Cubans in Florida, these expats, these capitalists who wanted to take the country by force. They trained them and they sent them in. And this was in 1961. This was in April of 1961 that this happened. And of course it failed. The Cuban intelligence apparatus intercepted them and met them and drove them off of the island and captured many of them. Now, the Cuban Missile Crisis was in 1962, over a year later. So this was self-defense. Mm-hmm. The United States had launched an attack on a sovereign nation. And Cuba said, well, we've got to defend ourselves. And so they lined up with the Soviet Union and said, okay, well, we'll accept the weapons, because this, they won't attack us with nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. They won't do this again. Mm-hmm. And so after this, then you have the embargo. So the United States, instead of invading again, launches an economic war that goes on until today. And so going to Barack Obama's meeting with Raul Castro, Obama, to me, is a very conflicted character, because
I agree.
He recognizes, you know, he recognizes himself as a black man, but he also has a particular allegiance to American empire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he walks, he tries to walk both lines, but there's tons of contradictions that come out of that. So one, he wanted to have peace with a place like Cuba, but he could not really extend a full arm of peace to Cuba. He could only make some concessions and say, well, you know, we'll lift some things as far as tourism so people can go in and buy some things, which will not only stimulate the Cuban economy, will of course stimulate U.S. capitalism and allow Cubans on the island to meet with sympathetic Americans who can then spread, be a vehicle for propaganda. And we're seeing some of the outcomes of that today with these protests that happened recently on the island of Cuba. And some of the things that were facilitated by the USAID program under Barack Obama's administration, where they have gone in and created a hip-hop scene or supported, funded a hip-hop scene in Cuba, which is anti-government. And so now we see protests and a slogan coming from the protests, which is a contrast to Fidel Castro's slogan of homeland or death. The slogan of this protest was homeland and life, but that came from a hip-hop group. And so we see how the Obama was used as a bridge for American imperialism to open a door to the USAID, make it fund hip, subversive hip-hop or subversive arts program that could lead to a counter-revolutionary protest like we'd like to be seen.
Like we've been seeing, right, that's going on right now, Because, see, when you see that on TV, and of course, the object of Western television is to promote that idea. So you don't, they're not going to say the reason why the people are in the streets is because of this embargo, which has afflicted these people for decades and caused all kinds of human misery because of why there are shortages of food and other necessities. No, they're going to blame it on the system as if the Cuban government is hoarding food and intentionally starving the people out and not providing jobs and not providing necessities for them to live a decent life. See, that's the impression that the right. West wants to give people who are watching. So you will have a unfavorable opinion about what's happening in Cuba.
Right, exactly. And going back to Barack Obama, my impression of what he did, you know, his vice president is the president of the United States now.
Exactly.
This is the same vice president who is now president, who on his campaign was saying that he was going to roll back Trump's extension of the embargo. But he hasn't rolled back anything. In fact, during this healthcare crisis of COVID-19 pandemic, he's dangling the vaccines in Cuba's face and saying, while the numbers of infection due to this Delta COVID-19 variant, while the numbers of infections are rising in Cuba, he's saying, we've got excess vaccines. He's saying the United States of America has excess vaccine. We have surplus vaccine. We'll give it to you, Cuba, on the condition that the government does not oversee the distribution of the vaccine. That is such a inhuman position to take in the midst of a global healthcare crisis to say that we have the means to help your citizens, but we're not going to give it to you unless you move out of the way. That doesn't make sense. Imagine that this is the same nation, Cuba, that during Hurricane Katrina offered its doctors, offered a fleet of doctors to send to the United States. Yes. They didn't say, we'll send doctors to the United States to help your citizens who are struggling in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast on the condition that the government of the United States is not involved. They didn't say that. They said under no strings attached.
Right.
There are no conditions for this. And the United States said no.
Right.
So the hypocrisy here and the inhumanity of Joe Biden, the former vice president of Barack Obama, in this process of supposedly being the benevolent United States of America, seeking out human rights and advancing democracy around the world, we see this hypocrisy front and center in this period of time as it relates to Cuba.
And so it is visible, deeply visible, especially when you understand the history, you know. And because of what Trump did when he got in, because you could take a Southwest airline flight from Atlanta to Havana. You can't now. And I'm not sure you'll be able to do it in the very near future. But at that time when that relationship was trying to be developed the way it was, they had opened up the borders where you could fly. Well, you could still get to Havana. You just can't go from Atlanta to Havana. You can go to Atlanta to one of the islands, you know, maybe, you know, and then
right.
and then go to Havana, you know. But, yeah. And so,
and you know,
go ahead.
I just wanted to say, when we talk about the system in Cuba and the struggling masses in Cuba, some, you know, a very small portion of which protested, but a much larger portion, which is not shown on U.S. media by and large, a much larger portion got into the streets to support the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
They marched against that counter-revolutionary protest, and they said, we support the Cuban government. We support the Cuban revolution. And what they don't say about why it is people are struggling in relation to this embargo, which we got to see recently from the ambassador and from Cuba, is that this has cost, in nearly 60 years, this embargo has cost Cuba $174 billion. $174 billion in the course of nearly 60 years. Imagine how they could have taken care of their people,
yeah,
their population, if they had that $174 billion back.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And the fact that it does do what it, you know, the fact that the Cuban government has produced all of these doctors and educated many doctors. In fact, when I was in Cuba, I went to the hospital where they're training doctors from around the globe. And of course, the stipulation, of course, is that when you return to your area, you serve undeveloped communities, you know. And a sister from Milwaukee, she was in the school at the time, a sister named Joy Mosley. And I met about five young brothers and sisters from the Oakland area, met many. I'm going to be honest with you, though. I didn't see a lot of Cuban Africans at the hospital or has, you know, or administrators, because when we met with them and talked about it, and then the students, then we met with the students, you know, the students were from an array of countries at that time, African countries, U.S., Caribbean, Central America, and so forth, you know. But the instructors were pretty much all not African Cubans, I mean Cuban Africans, but mostly Cuban looking Caucasian. So, you know, and that was the issue. And I made mention of that when we met, you know, because I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm quite sure the island of Cuba has had a lot of Africans on them, more Africans than probably what they have stated, the percentage they have stated, because of how, you know, what the whole Caribbean has been about. The Caribbean has been about,
exactly,
you know, Africans being displaced by Africans displacing more indigenous people for working at farms, plantations, whatever, with bananas, sugar cane, you name it, you know. And I know when captivity was beginning to end in some places, like, say, for instance, Argentina. Well, Argentina killed us and got rid of us. They tried to make Argentina like it never had any captives, and it was always Caucasian, you know. And that's been done in a few other places, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there's a need for more Africans. And, you know, this is a struggle that we have in many places throughout the world, mm-hmm. Just making sure that Africans can rise up to leadership. But I'm confident that Cuba is one of the central places in which this can happen, and happen in a way in which Africans can be represented not as tokens or just talking heads, but actually people with power and influence. And in fact, there are African people under this newer administration mm-hmm. who have risen up into leadership positions in the government, in the central government of Cuba. So, you know, we're seeing a progress as generations go.
Right.
And they may be a little bit slower in process in a place like Cuba because of the government structure. But as generations go, we are seeing African people rise up into political power.
Listen, we want to take a break. When we come back from the break, there'll be more information provided for you on Cuba and the island of Haiti and what's going on to give you a clear picture from an African viewpoint, from an African-centered perspective. Because after all, this is what the program is, African Perspectives. So I want to thank my guest, Brother Kwaku Lumumba. And we're going to be right back, brothers and sisters. You stay with us. You're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. We'll be right back. You stay with us.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. This program is being recorded, and it's too bad because I'm quite sure a lot of listeners would love to talk to you, my brother, the kind of information that you provide. But I'm really grateful that you're hanging with me this morning. So, once again, my guest is Brother Kwaku Lumumba. And Brother Lumumba, let's finish up talking about Cuba, and then we can get to Haiti in specifics about all the dynamics that are going on there, you know.
Sure. Well, I'm glad to be spending this morning with you as well. No better place that I could be than having a conversation with you about our revolutionary history in Cuba and Haiti.
I appreciate it. In fact, I hope that we can do this again and again. Yes. Maybe hopefully next time we can find the time to have an audience and get more people involved. But I'm going to put this on the Facebook and other things that me and you having this conversation. So hopefully we'll get a lot of people to listen in on this very important information. Because, you know, you have impressed me a lot with the knowledge of what's happening in the Caribbean and as far as all the dynamics, you know, that are going on in the world as it relates to geopolitics and you know, what's happening with the Europeans' imperialism and its imposition on other countries and how they put a stranglehold on other countries, just like you mentioned, the vaccine that is available. But this government said to Cuba, if you want some of this vaccine, then, you know, we'll give it to you. But your government, which controls everything, this government controls everything here. You know? It's just a contradiction, man.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, and in regards to, as we left off talking about African leadership in Cuba, the Cuban ambassador to the United Nations, Pedro Luis Pedrosa Suesta, is an African. We're seeing a wave of African people in Cuba who have put in the years, because in Cuba, you don't just step up to political power overnight like Obama did in a lot of ways in the United States, just after being in his position for just a few years as a junior senator.
Right, state senator. In Chicago. Yeah, I mean, I was in Chicago, man. At the time, I was at the National Black United Front meeting. And Brother Conrad Worrell, who now is an ancestor, man, missed that brother. He had invited Jesse, along with Barack Obama, who was running for U.S. Senator at the time. And so he comes to our meeting and got a chance to meet him. And then I saw him again on, because I never heard of Barack Obama. Well, of course, I'm in Milwaukee. I wasn't in Chicago. He's a state senator in Illinois, you know. And so he comes in, shakes hands, of course. I don't remember even saying too much of anything. And then I saw him again on the news that night. And, of course, he won U.S. Senate. He won the U.S. Senate seat, and he was invited to speak at the Democratic National Convention. And that was his coming out right there, you know. Even though Hillary was supposed to be the candidate, you know, he dusted her in the debates and had a better presence. But one could argue, Brother Kwaku, that he had, you know, can't have a better connection than Hillary, but he was more willing to go along with the get along, maybe. I don't know, you know.
Well,
that's why he was selected.
And then after he won, he made her Secretary of State. So,
yeah, there it is.
He gave her a very powerful, one of the most powerful positions in the cabinet, and because she was able to advance her particular agenda around the world. The only thing she wasn't doing was calling the shots domestically, but she was calling all the shots internationally.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and her, that's why, you know, to me, the blood is on her hands as well as Barack Obama's hands for the assassination or the murder of Muammar Gaddafi, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I'll never forget seeing the recording, which she didn't realize it was a recording of that, when she was on or preparing for an interview and she was laughing. She said, "We came, we saw,
and we
conquered. He died.
He died, yeah, yeah."
And she was laughing about Muammar Gaddafi.
Yeah.
That was her crowning achievement as Secretary of State under
Barack Obama. You know, I have, if anybody has ever listened to this program or know me, they know I have a deep disdain and disgust for the Clintons. I hate the Clintons. I hated the Clintons from the very moment. And then, of course, when they pulled what they pulled off in Haiti, the amount of money that they stole from Haiti during the earthquake, oh, it's just criminal. And I remember when she was running, a brother from Haiti, he got a little bit of a play. He was petitioning her or boycotting her or, you know, making an issue of what happened in Haiti. Hey, what? You stole our money. You know, when she was campaigning, you know. So, no, I have no feelings at all. I can't stand the Clintons at all. And so, you know, but what is, as far as Cuba is concerned at this time, with all that is going on, what is your prognosis or outlook of what's happening now in Cuba?
Well, Cuba is going through a transition in leadership. Of course, the you know, Fidel Castro transitioned, as you mentioned before. His brother, Raul Castro, is still in Cuba. He's still in power within the government. He's not the president anymore, but he still has a lot of sway in the government as far as the Communist Party structure.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, when the situation happened and you saw it a couple of weeks ago, he came into the people. Raul came in when they were demonstrating and so forth. And, you know, if it was real about what's happening in Cuba, he wouldn't have done that. He couldn't have done that.
Right. Right.
You know, he could not have come out. They would have gave him a beat down or worse. So it lets you know how much BS, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Cuba has done a great job of being resilient in the process of dealing with this economic blockade and making sure that the people that are transitioning into power have put in work. They're not just figureheads, not just people who look good on TV or can give good speeches, but they put in work over the years in Cuba. They have served the interests of the Cuban Revolution, and they've proven themselves worthy of rising up the ranks into leadership. And so they're going through that transition now where they're trying to make certain reforms without compromising on their socialist principles in Cuba and make sure that they can continue to move forward in the same way that they started in the 1960s, in the 21st century. So, you know, it's a difficult time. It's a difficult transition to make, especially when you don't have access to the sort of resources that they should have if the U.S. embargo were not in place. But fortunately, we have programs like this, like yours, and other international forums that are speaking up on behalf of the Cuban people, speaking up on behalf of the Cuban Revolution, to say that this embargo, this economic blockade that the United States has imposed on Cuba since 1962 is against every form of human rights. It is not a legal form of engaging with a country. And it's clear now that it is not about the Castro regime. Because if it were about Castro, then it would have ended when Fidel Castro died. Or at the very least, once there was a new president in Cuba. But we see that it is an attempt to overthrow the Cuban Revolution, an attempt at regime change, at strangling the nation to the point where they can convince the population to rise up against the government and upend the success of the Cuban Revolution in the face of U.S. imperialism. And so we don't expect, you know, if we transition to Haiti, the Haitian revolution caused IET to suffer punishment for over 200 years.
Yeah.
So we don't expect the United States to relent its position on Cuba, because Cuba is being punished for the Cuban Revolution. They haven't even made it 100 years of punishment yet. So we recognize that there has to be some concerted international effort against U.S. imperialism in order to free Cuba and IET from the punishment that they've been enduring for generations now.
Yeah, because, you know, the idea, that's why they said, no, we cannot have some Africans defeating some Europeans in this hemisphere. We can't have it. If it did happen, we got to come together and suppress it. So they came together. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. They came together because, you know, they had the whole island of whatever you want to call it, Hispaniola or, hell, Haiti. They had the whole island. But America, with Spain, with Britain, and, of course, a weakened France, made a move on to Haiti, and they said to them, we will crush you militarily if you don't yield. And then the Spanish came in and took the eastern part of the island and made it Dominican Republic. And then the French made Haiti pay reparations, even though France, just as they did in Africa and other places, when they're made to leave, they tear stuff up. They destroy it. And they did that in Haiti. But yet, they received reparations. My friend, another brother named Kwaku, has always said, Europeans have never paid restitution or suffered the consequences for their behavior. They did it, and you're supposed to say, oh, well, you know, let's move on. Just like I was in Tulsa a few weeks last month, the beginning of last month. And it's documented what these Caucasians did in Tulsa. It's not hearsay. This one brother literally documented where the people lived, the goods and services that they had in their homes, the value of their homes and so forth, because he was going to petition to the government as well as the insurance companies for these brothers to get and sisters to get compensated for the loss of their property and loss of their lives. And yet, the city of Tulsa, the state of Oklahoma, and the United Snakes consistently railroaded them. The insurance companies would not hear them, to the point they said later that this is a statute of limitations. You can no longer petition us. You ran out of time. There is no limit. There is no statute of limitations on murder. These brothers should have been compensated. And now today, all that is left of Black Wall Street is one block. One block with a couple of businesses on each side of that. And that's it. They have never suffer the consequences of their evil behavior.
And it's upon us to make sure that they suffer the consequences.
That's right.
Because we can't trust that their brothers and sisters, that their cousins and uncles, nephews and nieces are going to hold them accountable. It's upon the African masses throughout the world to come together to organize collectively, as we talked about in the beginning of the program, collective work and responsibility and making sure that we get what is owed to us, because we can't expect anybody to just give it to us. We have to go out, organize, and take it.
Right. And see, the thing about us, unfortunately, we don't recognize that it can be done, because we have been trained by a system that values individualism as opposed to being collective, that values the me. And I read that too in the Inye Say Sim this morning. And so, you know, because of the situation that we are in, we are afraid
to step outside of the imposed boundaries that these Europeans have placed upon us. We're afraid to release the vice grip that they have on our minds so that we can think clearly and begin to trust one another, respect one another, work with one another. There's a whole bunch of things that we can do when we unify. But as long as we are fragmented, as long as we believe in this system, you know, when they killed Muammar Gaddafi, as you and I both know, and I hope everybody really knows, that they killed Muammar Gaddafi, not because, you know, they tried to, the propaganda, what you see, just like you see on American television, you see on television that the people were rioting. That wasn't Libyans. Libyans love Muammar Gaddafi. It's unbelievable what they were providing for the Libyan people when they got married, $50,000, a place that they could stay, fuel was inexpensive, and so forth. No, they used the mineral, they used the petroleum wealth for the benefit of the people. But what they wanted the American people and Western people to understand, no, Muammar Gaddafi is a dictator, he's a tyrant, he's taking the money, the people are starving, this, that, and the other. They're uprising, justifying moving in there to kill him. But the main reason was that he was going to introduce a gold coin, a gold dinar that could be utilized throughout the continent of Africa. At the time, of course, he was the president of the AU. I think I lost my brother. Hope he can give me a call back. Yeah. And so he was going to use that coin for the benefit of Africa. And if Africa could have done that, imagine where Africans would be, where the continent of Africa would be. See, you can't have that, you know. So, yeah, there he is. Okay, my brother.
Yes. Sorry, we were disconnected. But I was saying that you're spot on about everything that you said in relation to the draining of wealth from IEC, a newly independent IEC, to go back to the French Empire and then subsequently to the American Empire. But I wanted to add something in there that we don't often consider because it's not often told. And it's important for us to consider this because we still deal with it today, and we're going to deal with it as we continue our liberation struggles. It's the element of treachery in our movements, in our revolutions. The fact of the matter is that after the Haitian Revolution was betrayed by mulatto children of mm-hmm. France, mm-hmm. namely the president Pétion, who succeeded Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Emperor Dessalines, in becoming a ruler on the island of Haiti, only in the south, though. He didn't rule the entire death. That's where the republic came into play. After Jean-Jacques Dessalines was assassinated, he was betrayed, then you had Pétion rise up as a republican president in the south of the island. One of the first things that he did was petition France to recognize the Republic of Haiti. And he, as somebody whose father was French, he appealed to France. And his appeal to the then King Louis the 18th was, we will pay you 15 million francs to recognize us. So he was willing to sell out the revolution to the Empire of France and say, look, we know that we broke free. We know we did what we did. But look, here's an amend. We'll pay you $15 million to recognize us as an independent and free nation. Well, Louis was not interested in dealing with them at all. He just shut it down. And he never accepted the offer in spite of President Pétion continuing to offer this money, this liberation money, as a debt of forgiveness to France. Well, once he was succeeded by President Boyer in Haiti, and King Louis in France was succeeded by Charles X in France. Boyer continued this petition. He said, look, King Charles of France, we will offer you 15 million francs in order to recognize Haiti as a free and independent republic. Charles said no to the $15 million, and he upped it. He said, 150.
Wow.
Sorry, not $15 million. 150 million francs to recognize Haiti as a free and independent nation. Now, Boyer didn't want to do that. He did want to pay. He did want to negotiate a payment, but he didn't want to pay 150 million francs. And so then, after, that's when the warships came in and said, well, this is our terms. If you don't accept the $150 million,
blow you
150 away. Million francs, then we'll go to war with you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what Boyer, if he were a revolutionary, if he were committed to the Haitian Revolution, what he would have done is, okay, we're going to go to war. We're going to defend ourselves. But no, he said, all right, we'll pay the 150 million francs just to be recognized. And so that's what happened. You had people who betrayed the revolution and then sold out the nation just to be recognized by their European fathers. So it's important for us to tell that story as well, because otherwise we just think it was a strong arm by a French empire over Haiti. But no, there were negotiations. It was the sellouts who first approached France to say, accept us, recognize us, we'll pay you for it. And then France, of course, renegotiated and said, well, you're going to pay us more. And if you don't, we're going to go to war. And so we have to recognize that, because we still have those kinds of people who are conflicted about their identity and who they should be loyal to.
Yes.
They're still in our midst.
Yes.
And they're still willing to sell us out in favor of being recognized by European power.
Yeah. That's why Dr. Jainry Clark said, you know, he didn't do it, but he said he wanted to write a book on the bastard in our revolution. Yes. He wanted to write a book on it, that who consistently betrayed us, you know, for the favors. I think that was when you look at Sankofa. That's played out in the movie Sankofa, too. Man, yeah, the bastard. The high yellow.
But yeah, so that's a dangerous thing, and they've used that as a weapon of war against us, because you know, even for those of us who fall into the trap of saying, well, Africans sold us out in Africa, they sold us into slavery. Well, we have to recognize the role that Europeans played, because they set up shop and they made sure that they married or had children with African royalty. And their children, their mulatto children, their bastard children, were the ones who were in charge of managing the slave trade by and large on the coast of West Africa. And so they use their genetics, they use racism in order to create a class of people who are conflicted about their loyalties, or tend to have access to African spaces, but are loyal to European colonial powers. And so we have to be careful with that. And we have to make sure that even if our people are in that situation, that we can re-Africanize them. The mind is an important place for our struggle to take place.
Oh, it is.
You can't just look at a brother and sister and say, oh, you have melanin in your skin, join us in the revolution. No education is needed. No political education.
No,
nothing is needed. We all need to be re-Africanized in the struggle.
That's right. That's vital. That's vitally important, because it is, our minds are so messed up. As you're talking, I'm thinking about a movie with James Earl Jones. Actually, he's narrating it. It's on the Haitian Revolution and many of the light-skinned people who left Haiti and came to New Orleans. Feast of All Saints. Feast of All Saints. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but I would hope that there's a time that you can find that movie, Feast of All Saints. Because basically what it deals with is the high yellow Africans, the mulattoes, who did not want to be under the rule of of an independent Haiti, and they went to New Orleans. And, of course, the women who were prostitutes but who were not deeply melanated, they had children by men who were married and aristocratic, and the hope would be that they would send those children to France to be educated, and that it would come back. And they are the buffer between us Africans who want true liberation and independence and the European who the France or whoever else wants to continue in our subjugation. They are the buffer. So they're given favor, you know, and as long as they continue to do their job, which is, you know, deny us. And that's, you know, that's a movie you need to check out. Feast of All Saints.
I will. Thank you very much. I haven't seen it, but I look forward to it.
Yeah. And when you do, let me know. I've been pushing and promoting two documentaries, and one is pretty much in that same vein because it's done by a Haitian named Raul Peck. I don't know if you've seen Exterminate All the Brutes.
That's on my list to watch. I am aware of that one.
Okay, good. Good. Exterminate All the Brutes, and that's on HBO. And if you know somebody who's at streaming, you can watch all four episodes, which is an hour apiece. And then the other one is Great Pyramid K, 2019. Great Pyramid K, 2019. What this documentary tells and shows, who built the pyramids, us, and more importantly, how they were built, is very deep. It is extremely deep. It's 3.5 hours, over 3.5 hours long, but it is well worth the watch. It is dynamic. It is a game changer if you really want to get off into it. So great pyramid. You can get that on YouTube, so you can go online on YouTube and put in Great Pyramid K 2019 and go ahead and deal with that. And if you do that, please give me a call and let me know about what you thought about at least those three things, you know, the movie.
Sure.
Okay. I'd appreciate it. So, but anyway, back to the conversation, you know, the assassination. Now, Haiti has had, you know, some hellified leadership or lack thereof. The Duvaliers, Baby Doc, Papa Doc, you know, of course, the disposing of Jean Bertrand Aristide and other leaders. And, of course, the one who was just assassinated, who just said, I'm not stepping down as, you know, as president. You know, I see something in the Constitution that I can be here, what, another year or two or something like that? So then, well, I don't know, you know.
Right.
But I mean, that's what it seemed like, you know. And of course, all of these people were the USA was in favor of them, you know. And to me, anytime the European is in favor of somebody, I'm against them. You know, it's just automatic. You know, if they like them, I don't, because there's definitely something wrong, you know. Mm-hmm. But he was he assassinated internally, or was he assassinated by some external forces?
Well, this has all the markings. This has all the markings of an internal operation, because he wasn't protected by his bodyguard, which were Haitian. But we have to look at the milieu in which that he allowed to be and was responsible for fostering in Haiti prior to his assassination. The national police in Haiti, which he is responsible for making sure that they're paid, they would go several months without being paid. So when you use a police force to terrorize a population and use them at your whim, but you're not paying, they're not eating, you're not paying them. I remember being in IET after Hurricane Matthew and going to provide some relief to communities, particularly in the north and in the northwestern portion of the nation, in Grand Anse. And we secured several bags of rice and beans to distribute at no cost to the masses, to them, because they didn't have access to food to feed their families. And the police were facilitating this process of making sure that we could distribute this in an orderly manner, because there were mobs that were following, chasing us on foot to different locations just to get a ticket, because we passed out tickets to make sure that people weren't duplicating their allotments, because we didn't have an unlimited supply. Well, the police took their cut. The police made sure that they got a certain allotment of rice, which was more than a bag apiece, for facilitating this process, because they weren't being paid by the government. They were hungry too. Imagine being a full-time employed government personnel and you're not getting paid. And you have to get rice from a benevolent international organization, just like any other citizen who's gone through the crisis, because the government is not paying you. So these are the people who were charged with protecting him. So you can understand why they would be open to the highest bidder, whoever would pay them and say, look, stand down. Let us get to him. Here's your money so you can feed your family. He was not taking care of his business as president, but he was eating well. He had plenty of money, but his security forces did not. In addition to the international intrigue in this, because we see Colombians involved in this process, mercenaries involved in this, this was a president who had created an environment of mercenary infiltration. He hired international mercenaries to assassinate Haitian citizens. As recently as 2019, this was exposed. We had been saying it for years prior to 2019, that Jovenel Moïse had American white people, mercenaries, in his employ who were disguised as military and police personnel, and they would cover their faces with masks and they cover their hands with gloves so that you could not see any white skin. But they would be there infiltrating that so that they could be snipers and they could shoot and instigate conflicts on the ground and then kill people without it looking like there was an external force at play. When this was exposed in early 2019, and these American and Serbian mercenaries were up for trial in IET, the U.S. Embassy came in, secured these mercenaries, put them on American Airlines Flight 971, flew them to Miami, Florida, and released them. They suffered no consequences.
Wow.
For killing innocent Haitian citizens.
And
they did not have to go to court.
And the Haitian government allowed this to happen, or actually make it sound like they made it happen.
Yes, they were there. They were there for years. This was happening for years. We have the video evidence of these snipers and towers in Port-au-Prince with their arms. We have the video, the photographic evidence of them in disguise and some of their skin exposed. We have all the evidence. We've been exposing that in different mediums so that people could see. But it took them being exposed fully at that period of time for people to finally believe that this was happening. And of course, they disavowed their involvement in this, but it was happening because Jovenel Moïse was allowing it and inviting it to happen in the country on his behalf. And so he created this situation in which you have an influx of international mercenaries coming in to do this kind of work. And so it's not surprising to see that it would turn against him, because he was not taking care of the people who were supposed to be protecting him and taking care of him. So it was an internal operation that used external support. And we see the Colombian intrigue and tie-in, and we see other players that are being arrested that have connections with the DEA. They've been DEA informants to make sure that certain people were arrested when the DEA saw fit. So there's a lot of things at play here, but ultimately, if Joe Nell were doing the work of taking care of the nation properly and not terrorizing the nation, this sort of thing would not have happened to him, at least not in this way.
So from my understanding, too, that he was tortured by these.
It looks that way. It looks that way
by
because
these individuals.
He had broken bones. He had broken arms, broken legs. His skull was cracked open, in addition to his eye being gouged.
Wow.
And so we know that his body was shot up. We know that's how he died. But there are signs that he may have been tortured prior to being killed.
Because once you shoot him, he's dead. I don't think you're going to break bones. No need in that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, all the signs of a personal vendetta against him are there, but we've yet to see who exactly is responsible. And I would imagine that it's not just one person, that it was a collective effort to lead to his demise. And we may never know, but it'll be interesting to see what his wife has to say, if anything, because since she survived it, but she was also brought to Florida and had extensive conversations with the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. We know that once they get into the conversation, that they start to control the narrative. So it'll be interesting that she says anything
right
at this point, because they want to make sure that they control the narrative from this point on.
It's going to be interesting to see who. I think that there's somebody was interim, and then now there's a gentleman, from my understanding, who claims that he is going to be the new president or prime minister, whatever, the head of state, whoever. Not the one that took over immediately once Moise was disposed, but somebody else coming on the scene. Are you aware of that?
Yes. So Claude Joseph was the one that you mentioned came on the scene and was recognized by the United States as the interim prime minister, in spite of the fact that Jovenel had removed him from his position before he was assassinated. And then he had named this other guy that you're talking about, Ariel Henry,
okay,
as the prime minister. However, he, in spite of the fact that he had named him on July 5th, he did not get a chance to be sworn in. And so Claude Joseph came up and said that he was the prime minister, that he was the rightful prime minister. Ariel said that he was the rightful prime minister. And then you even had another person who was the president of the Senate who came up, Joseph Lambert, who came up with some support saying that he should be the president. So you had the three different people vying for leadership in IET until just now, where now the United States has decided that the transition should be with Ariel Henry. And now we'll see. As things go on, there are a lot of people who were staged opposition that we're going to call controlled opposition for several years who are now getting seats or positions of power in this new transitional government. And so, it's interesting because a lot of people who said that they were representing the interests of the people or the masses, now they were quiet and now they're coming up to get power position. They're not actually fighting for the people. They were just fighting for themselves in their own pockets. So a lot of things are coming out now that people can watch and see who is really on the side of the masses and moving things in a way that will support the masses and be in line with the Haitian Revolution. And who are the traitors? Who are the people like Petion, like Boyer, who just want to cut deals, who just want to negotiate and just want to get paid or make payments to be recognized by the United States as legitimate. So we're seeing this play out in the 21st century, just as we saw it play out in the 19th century.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be interesting these next few months as we move towards the end of this year, of how it plays out in both Haiti and in Cuba, you know. And what's interesting for me is that I have no faith at all that something, quote, revolutionary will happen that will be a benefit to the Cuban people or to the Haitian people. You know, I believe it will be the same manipulation, the same cover up, the same puppet, you know, cronies and so forth. It's unfortunate, but I hope I'm wrong. You know, surprise me, please.
That would be a surprise.
That would, wouldn't it? That would be a surprise. That would be a shock. Well, I'm ready for a shock. That would be great. But I know, unfortunately, that definitely may not happen because it seems not to be in these people. You know, they've made the world a despicable and evil place. And you'd think with the advent of communications where you can see things happen in real time at this very moment around the world or in a different country, even in a remote place, is possible. But yet, dirty dealings, underhandedness, undermining, supplanting, all of these things continue to take place. One of the main culprits is Europeans, whether you want to call them Russians, whether you want to call them any Australia, whatever you want to call them, is Europeans. Looking at their history of what they've done, that's why they want to control the narrative. That's why they're very afraid of critical race theory. That's why that documentary I mentioned, Exterminate All the Brutes, is critical race theory, because it tells you who these people are. And it explains and it says three things. There is civilization. Then there is colonization. And then extermination. When you look at how these people have dealt with the world, they have killed millions and millions of people. When they came here to this land, this was not barren. There were many nations of people on this in North America, and particularly in the so-called United States. Millions of people that they just took their land, put them on reservations, or just killed them. That's how the movie begins. The antagonist, the Caucasian military dude, is going into Florida trying to get his, quote, property of the brothers and sisters who escaped into Florida to live with the Seminoles. And he goes down there. They're not going to let him go. So he shoots the person who came out to talk about or negotiate, shoots her in the head, and next thing you see the people dead everywhere and the village is burned. That's how they operate. You know, so I have zero faith at all in a positive solution coming out of Haiti. More of a positive solution hopefully coming out of Cuba. I don't know. Remains to be seen. We only have a few more minutes, my brother. So you go ahead and you wrap it up for us, okay? I appreciate this opportunity, and I'm quite sure there'll be more.
Yes, I appreciate it, too. It's been a great conversation. Look forward to having many more, and honoring the ancestors, respect for their legacy and the work that we have to continue. Cuba and Haiti are linked together in revolutionary history and revolutionary struggle. I think hopefully we've demonstrated that in the course of this conversation. And we just want to extend the opportunity for your listeners to reach out to the organization COSA, Convite Citoyen Socialiste Sobre Haiti, and they can go to the website at kossa.com. That's K as in kangaroo, O, three S's, A as in apple.com. Or they can call the External Relations Office at 404-884-6638. That's 404-884-6638 for the External Relations Office. And I wanted to remark on that indigenous comment that you made that I look forward to seeing in that documentary, Exterminate All the Groups. Because as an African person, I'm also an indigenous person. I'm Afro-Indigenous. So I have that connection to the colonized or occupied space of the United States as well. So we've got Cuba, we've got Haiti, of course, we've got Africa. But we also have the space as well. And funny enough, the people that I'm connected to ancestrally, the Ishak, they had two words for what we call white people or Europeans. One of them was Kiwilch.
What is it? Say it again. What
Kiwilch.
Is it? Kiwilch.
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 And it means, it basically translates, or it means, not translate, but it means like an undeveloped person.
Mm.
So they recognize that these weren't fully developed human beings.
Yes. Just like.
But that was in the nature of their character.
Mm-hmm.
The other term, which is much more telling, and I imagine that this came about after they got to know them a little bit better, is Shakao. Shakao means a dead person.
Mm.
So they went from seeing these people as, oh, they're not fully developed, or basically they're not civilized, to seeing how they behave and saying they're not human at all.
Yeah.
These are dead people.
Just like Mama Marimba with the term Yorugu. You know, the incomplete being. You know? That wants to dominate and control everything. This is deep, yeah.
So, you know, we have to tap into our ancestors.
That's right.
Every step along the way of the revolution, because we're not going to have a revolution without our roots. And our ancestors are our roots. Mm-hmm. And we have to carry our roots so that we can continue to plant seeds of revolution going forward in the 21st century. Right. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, my brother.
Look forward to the next time.
Thank you. Brothers and sisters, we appreciate Brother Kwaku Lumumba. Brothers and sisters, we end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without, and they sure in the hell don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, you have a blessed and wonderful weekend. Shem Hotep means go in peace. Asante Sana means thank you. Bibi Fahodie. Bibi Fahodie means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we will be victorious. Peace, family.